markets. So although Converse believed that no more than 15% of the population in 1956 satisfied the criteria for being ideological, others, including Chick Judd and John Krosnick, have obtained higher estimates, with some estimates, not theirs, but others' estimates going as high as 50%. The increased prevalence of ideological coherence in the decades after Converse's original essay was published has been attributed largely to methodological improvements in survey items and to increased political polarization in certain elections, including the famous 1972 Nixon-McGovern race, and again in very recent elections. In addition, as educational levels in the American public have risen, we've also seen greater ideological interest and consistency. Converse is clearly right that a sizable minority, sometimes as much as one-third of the population, appears to be unable or unwilling to locate their political attitudes on a scale of liberalism, conservatism. But on the flip side, if you look at the American National Election Studies data from 1972 to 2004, you see that two-thirds of respondents since 1972 and three-fourths of respondents since 1996 can and do organize their attitudes according to reference such as liberalism and conservatism, and I'm going to suggest in a couple of minutes that they appear to do so in a relatively accurate and behaviorally congruent way. So much as survey researchers in the 1980s concluded that the American public was much more ideologically inclined than it had been in the 1950s, it seems to many observers that the American public today is more ideologically inclined than it was in the 1980s. Party loyalty, for example, has increased, and so has the proportion of strict party line votes in Congress. Ticket splitting, in which voters simultaneously cast ballots for Democratic and Republican candidates, has dramatically decreased, and so has political competitiveness in most counties, and not only because of partisan gerrymandering. Political segregation is occurring more rapidly than racial segregation, and it appears to many observers that the nation is currently in the midst of the most partisan era since Reconstruction, that is, following slavery. A final point that I'd like to make with respect to work on ideological coherence is that the question of whether the electorate can be both highly ideological and generally uninformed, in my opinion, remains untouched by most of the political science literature, in part because of the way that they've defined ideology. So from the perspective of a motivated social cognitive approach like the one that we've been advocating in the last few years, one would expect that rather than solely organizing information accurately and logically, ideology would encourage distortion and selective processing of political information. And there's, in fact, as many of you know, a wealth of experimental evidence that illustrates the biasing role of ideology, and there's anecdotal evidence as well. 1/4 of American citizens, between 1 and 2 million people per day, watch the ideologically laden Fox News, but surveys show that these viewers, while politically engaged, are significantly less informed than others about the Iraq War and other important political issues. So it seems to me that the strongest criticism of Converse's work may be conceptual, actually, rather than empirical, and that is that by equating ideology with internal consistency and internal consistency with sophistication, he and his adherents may have mischaracterized the role of ideology in people's lives altogether. A related and perhaps a more constructive suggestion is that people's attitudes may be, at least to some degree, structured around a left-right or liberal-conservative dimension for psychological reasons. And these are psychological reasons having relatively little to do with needs for consistency or reason per se, but rather because of other epistemic and existential motives pertaining to, for example, the management of uncertainty and threat. And I'll come back to this issue later, but first I want to say a bit more about the other end of ideology claims. Okay, so the second claim was that ordinary people don't care about ideology and that it plays no important role in motivating their political behavior. And again, I suspect that there was a time in which this generalization may have applied to the majority of the population, but there's at least anecdotal and archival and some survey evidence that suggests that people are more passionate about political ideology these days than in previous eras, for better or for worse. I'll leave that to you to decide. For yourselves. In the 2004 national election study, for example, 44% of respondents reported listening to political talk radio. According to a study by the Pew Center, Rush Limbaugh draws more than 15 million listeners per week. They call themselves the Ditto Heads, as you may know. And Bill O'Reilly counts 8% of the public as regular viewers. In terms of internet media, there are now more than 17,000 political websites maintained by thousands of individual bloggers and visited by at least 25 million Americans. It's estimated that the top 100 political blogs attract 100,000 American adults each day. So although liberal pundits may finally be starting to catch up, it seems to me that conservatives in the last decade or so have found ways of capitalizing on ideological passions that, according to the end of ideologists, simply didn't exist. With regard to voting behavior, it appears that ideological self-placement on a scale of liberalism and conservatism does predict voting intentions and behaviors to a very strong degree in the 1972 to 2004 presidential elections. So here is the Ains item, which has been much maligned in the literature, but it turns out to be pretty powerful, in my opinion. The item reads, "We hear a lot of talk these days about liberals and conservatives. Here's a 7-point scale on which the political views that people might hold are arranged from extremely liberal to extremely conservative. Where would you place yourself on this scale, or haven't you thought much about this?" And I didn't realize until yesterday that this question contains a rich, petty manipulation, I think, of attitude uncertainty thrown in there at the end of it. And that, along with the fact that there are three alternatives to actually answering this question, may help us to better understand why 25% of the respondents still are not answering this question. But let's talk about those people who do answer it. In this figure, I have aggregated national election studies data from 1972 to 2004 and plotted the percentage of respondents at each point on this 7-point ideological self-placement scale, again ranging from extremely liberal to extremely conservative, who reported voting for Democratic and Republican presidential candidates in the United States. So collapsing across the 9 presidential elections and over 7,500 respondents, what you see here is that 80% of respondents who describe themselves as liberal or extremely liberal reported voting for the Democratic candidates, and 80% of respondents who describe themselves as conservative or very conservative reported voting for the Republican candidates. The correlation between ideological self-placement and voting intentions is over 0.9. Responses to this single item explain 85% of the statistical variance in self-reported voting behavior over the last 32 years. So let me know if you can come up with one, but I find it difficult to think of another single survey question in the entire social and behavioral sciences that is as useful and as parsimonious as the liberalism, conservatism, self-placement item for predicting any outcome that is as important as voting behavior. It also predicts, in our various research programs, a great many other things about an individual's thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and I'm afraid I'm only going to be able to mention a few of these today. On the question of whether there are meaningful substantive differences between left-wing or liberal and right-wing or conservative ideologies, my colleagues and I, including Jack, find it useful to distinguish between core and peripheral features of an ideology. Peripheral features are those that are somewhat loosely connected to an ideology and are therefore more likely to show historical and cultural variability. So one example, I think, of a peripheral feature of conservative ideology is opposition to big government. And we're already seeing that conservatives' attitudes on this issue are changing now that big government is Republican government rather than Democratic government. Core features, by contrast, are more stable across time and place. We've proposed that, that, as Brian mentioned yesterday, two core dimensions that have distinguished left and right over the last 200 years or so in most societies. And these two dimensions are, first, attitudes concerning change or tradition, and second, attitudes concerning social and economic equality or inequality. So, for example, as you know, conservatives tend to hold significantly more favorable attitudes than liberals toward traditional cultural and family values, including religious forms of morality. Conservatives are also more likely to support conventional authority figures and to oppose activists who are seeking to change the status quo, especially if change is toward greater egalitarianism. Liberals generally place a higher priority on achieving social and economic equality through policies such as welfare, social security, and affirmative action. Liberals are also significantly less likely to hold prejudicial attitudes toward racial minorities, homosexuals, women, and members of other disadvantaged groups, as Brian showed us yesterday with respect to implicit as well as explicit attitudes. I also think that there is some evidence that political attitudes are more stable and more highly intercorrelated or tightly constrained, to use Converse's language, around core than peripheral attitude objects. So in general, my conclusion is that if you look in the right place, you will find meaningful differences at the level of ideological content between liberal and conservative ideologies. So it seems to me that the intriguing possibility, or at least a possibility that's intriguing to me, is that ideological preferences are derived in part from the psychological needs of individuals and groups. And this has not really been seriously considered by sociologists and political scientists, I think, over the last 40 years or so, perhaps because they've not really taken seriously the notion that individuals have genuine ideological preferences at all. From my point of view, the question of whether or not there are consistent psychological differences between liberals and conservatives is a legitimate and important empirical issue for the social and behavioral sciences. And so my colleagues, again, Jack Glazer, Arye Kruglansky, and Frank Soloway and I, adopted a quantitative meta-analytic approach to these issues, which I think had been obscured and to some extent even suppressed during the end of ideology era. A meta-analysis that we published in Psychological Bulletin included studies published between 1958 and 2002 involving 88 different research samples from 12 different countries listed there. And altogether, there were 22,818 individual cases or participants, as diverse as we could find. The most general theoretical proposition that we assessed is that there's a better match between both dispositional and situational needs to manage uncertainty and threat, and the specific contents of liberal or left-wing and, there's a better match between dispositional and situational needs to manage uncertainty and threat and conservative or right-wing ideologies than liberal and left-wing ideologies. And this would explain, we think, among other things, why 9/11, which served to increase general needs to manage uncertainty and threat in the general population, precipitated a conservative shift. Again, we focused on the two core aspects that differentiate conservative and liberal ideologies, and these occur repeatedly in historical and conceptual definitions of conservatism, namely resistance to change or traditionalism and acceptance of inequality. So consistent with prior theorizing, we hypothesized that there would be an especially good fit between needs to reduce uncertainty and threat on one hand and resistance to change and acceptance of inequality on the other, insofar as preserving the status quo allows one to maintain what is familiar and known while rejecting the risky, uncertain prospects associated with social change. So the broader argument, really, is that ideological differences between right and left emerge, at least in part, because of psychological reasons. Stability and hierarchy inherently provide reassurance and structure, whereas change and equality imply greater chaos and unpredictability, at least with respect to reasonably large social systems, although it might even be true in families and other smaller systems. So obviously this is a very ambitious theoretical project. I realize that to try to ground left and right in aspects of human nature, such as underlying psychological needs for stability versus change, order versus complexity, familiarity versus novelty, conformity versus creativity, and loyalty versus rebellion. And we're certainly not there yet by any means, but we are, I think, making some progress. In terms of operational definitions, our dependent variable, political orientation, that is conservative versus liberal, was operationalized in three ways. First, We looked at scales emphasizing resistance to change, of which there are several listed here. Second, we included scales emphasizing acceptance versus rejection of inequality. And third, there were also direct self-report indicators of political orientation. And the results were generally consistent across these three types of measures. We found that several variables pertaining to epistemic needs or motives to reduce uncertainty were associated with political orientation. For instance, integrative complexity was negatively associated with conservatism, more positively associated with liberalism. Intolerance of ambiguity was positively associated with conservatism, negatively with liberalism. Openness to experience and uncertainty tolerance were both negatively associated with conservatism, positively associated with liberalism. And needs for order, structure, and closure were also significantly and positively associated with political conservatism. We also found, again aggregating across many different studies, that certain existential needs or motives pertaining to the management of threat were associated with political orientation. So fear of threat and loss was positively associated with conservatism or negatively associated with liberalism. The smallest effect size was for self-esteem, a slight tendency in the years that the studies were conducted for lower self-esteem to be more associated with political conservatives, although we've seen that go away in the last few years in our research during the Bush years. The two largest effect sizes that came out of our meta-analysis were for death anxiety and system threat, each of which were correlated about 0.5 positively with political conservatism. And again, I think it's no accident that the events of 9/11 obviously affected people's levels of death anxiety and perceptions of system threat, and also appears to have precipitated a kind of conservative shift. Several recent studies, including experimental and quasi-experimental studies, reinforce and extend, I think, the basic conclusions arising from our meta-analysis. And these are particularly important because they shed further light on the direction of causality, demonstrating that heightened needs to manage uncertainty and threat lead to an increased affinity for conservatism and a decreased affinity for liberalism. Although I also do think that the other direction of causality is also plausible for a number of reasons, perhaps including reasons of social identification, as Jeff was just talking about, and perhaps also other forms of socialization and party organization and other things. Let me tell you about some of these more recent studies. Time series analyses conducted by the sociologist Rob Willer show that every time the Bush administration raised the terror alert levels during their first term in office, public approval ratings of Bush increased, even on dimensions unrelated to his handling of terrorism, such as economic issues. Second, although terror management theorists initially expected that mortality salience would increase liberalism among liberals, they too have recently begun to show that priming people with thoughts of death or 9/11 tend to increase support for conservative opinions and leaders, including President Bush, and even in relatively liberal college samples. And third, I've been working with George Bonanno, who is conducting a longitudinal study on trauma and resilience among people who were in or near the World Trade Center buildings on the morning of 9/11. And 18 months after 9/11, we simply asked these survivors if they had grown more liberal, more conservative, or stayed the same since the attack. And here are the results. 38% of the sample overall reported that they had become more conservative in the 18 months following 9/11, which was about three times as many people who said that they had grown more liberal. And if you break it down by political party, here you see that 50% of Republicans, 50% of independents, and 35% of Democrats reported that they had become more conservative in the 18 months after 9/11. And no Republicans, no independents, and only 23% of Democrats said that they had become more liberal in the 18 months following 9/11. If you look just at those people who said that they had voted for Al Gore in 2000, of those people, 40% of them reported that they had become more conservative in the 18 months following 9/11, and only 12% had become more liberal. So it really doesn't matter how you break it down. There's more conservative shift here. We also found in this sample that the survivor symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and depression predicted both a conservative orientation and also the likelihood of becoming more conservative in response to the attacks. So in this particular case, at least, although we're arguing that people may be turning to conservative solutions in part to minimize threat and uncertainty, in this particular case, it doesn't seem to have been effective. Although there is survey evidence out there in the general population that conservatives in general do report being happier on average. Okay. Finally, and I don't have too much time left, but I do want to mention one more thing. There were some built-in limitations of the meta-analysis that we're now trying to address in follow-up research. For one thing, we did not have uncertainty and threat variables in the same data sets, so we couldn't really tell whether they're contributing independently and equally to political orientation, or if one type of variable seems to be more important than the other. And given that we were relying mainly on previously published studies, we were also dependent on how other authors had reported their data. And so we had a limited ability to rule out the alternative hypothesis that heightened needs to manage uncertainty and threat would be associated with becoming more ideologically extreme in either direction, right or left. And finally, some of the DVs that we included in the meta-analysis, such as right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation, may include authoritarian characteristics that may be separable from conservatism, at least in principle, although there are generally rather high correlations between conservatism and authoritarianism, although there is some range as well. In any case, we used ideological self-placement as the dependent variable in three studies and used structural equation models methods on data taken from student samples from Texas, Massachusetts, and New York. And the results are highly consistent across the three samples, despite geographical and other differences among the samples. So I'll just describe briefly one of the studies as a kind of illustration. We created here second-order latent variables of uncertainty avoidance and threat management based on multiple scale indicators of each. To estimate uncertainty avoidance, we administered items pertaining to ambiguity and tolerance, openness, and the need for order subscale of Webster and Kuglansky's need for closure scale, which will be represented in the Ains pilot study, thanks to John and Skip. To estimate threat management, we administered items from the Perceptions of a Dangerous World scale, along with other items gauging system threat. And we were able to investigate the effects of these psychological variables on both liberalism, conservatism, and ideological extremity, adjusting for the other. Okay. And what we found was that in all three studies, uncertainty avoidance and threat management each contributed independently and significantly to political conservatism, accounting for between 28% and 38% of the statistical variance in political orientation. Furthermore, these paths remain significant after adjusting for ideological extremity. But when we allow uncertainty avoidance and threat management to predict political extremity rather than political orientation, we find no evidence that heightened epistemic or existential needs are associated with increased extremity. Rather, uncertainty avoidance was associated with the holding of centrist as well as conservative views, and threat management was unrelated to extremity in all three studies. This pattern holds after adjusting for the negative effect of conservatism on ideological extremity, that is, for the liberal skew in this particular sample. Okay, my overall conclusion today is that while ordinary people by no means pass the strictest tests imaginable for ideological sophistication, most of them, I think, do think, feel, and behave in ideologically meaningful and interpretable terms. Millions of Americans now actively seek out ideologically charged talk radio, televised news programs, and political blog sites. Between two-thirds and three-quarters of the American population currently locates their attitudes on a liberalism-conservatism dimension. And these attitudes do reliably predict voting behavior and other important outcomes, including beliefs, opinions, values, traits, behaviors, and perhaps even mental health characteristics. I've also suggested and shown some evidence that political and psychological differences between the left and the right do exist, especially with respect to core dimensions pertaining to stability versus change and equality versus inequality, and that both situational and dispositional needs to manage uncertainty and threat are associated with conservatism and not with ideological extremity. Finally, I think that we may be starting to witness in psychology a return to some of the questions that we deferred almost a half century ago, that were deferred almost a half century ago by the end of ideologists. And I also think that the emerging psychological paradigm is distinguishable from and hopefully complementary to political science approaches to ideology, which have stressed, among other things, coherence, stability, and political sophistication rather than other human needs and motives. Thank you. Yes.
Got about eight, but I'll let